From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story behind the film Heavenly Creatures. The movie is on Time Magazine's 10 Best list. Set in New Zealand in the early 1950s, it's based on the true story of two girls, Pauline and Juliet, who were best friends and created their own fantasy world. When Pauline's mother stood in the way of them staying together, they murdered her. A journalist recently revealed that one of those girls now writes popular mystery novels under the pen name Ann Perry. We'll feature an interview with Ann Perry, and we'll hear from the director and co-writers of Heavenly Creatures. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Little Women, directed by Australian filmmaker Gillian Armstrong. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New York authorities say the man they've arrested for allegedly firebombing a subway car yesterday has been charged with attempted murder and assault. Authorities believe extortion may have been the motive. Edward Leary of New Jersey has been charged in connection with the incident. The New York City Police Commissioner, says the bomb went off in Leary's hands. More bomb-making material was later found in his home. North Korea has returned the body of a U.S. pilot to American officials. He died when his helicopter went down in North Korean territory on Saturday. North Korean officials say the surviving co-pilot is well and will be released soon. The BBC's Charles Scanlon reports from Seoul, South Korea.
A coffin carrying the remains of Chief Warrant Officer David Heilman was handed over in a brief ceremony at the border village of Panmunjom. The repatriation took place after 5 days of sometimes frustrating negotiations with the North Koreans. The American Congressman Bill Richardson, who represented the Clinton administration at the talks, accompanied the coffin from Pyongyang.
Under the agreement, I return today with David Heilman, and Chief Warrant Officer Bobby Hall will return shortly.
He said he'd been unable to meet the surviving pilot, Bobby Hall, despite repeated requests. The North Korean news agency has reported that Chief Warrant Officer Hall is in good health, but it gave no further details. The North Koreans say he'll be returned once their investigation into the incident is complete.
Charles Scanlon reporting. The government says the nation's gross domestic product increased slightly in the third quarter of this year. The GDP was up 0.1% to 4% between July and September. The increase came despite efforts by the Federal Reserve to slow down the economy to fend off inflation. The Justice Department has issued a warning to deadbeat parents. They'll be sought for back child support payments. NPR's Melinda Pankava reports.
Since 1992, it has been a federal crime for parents to not send child support payments to their children living in another state, but enforcement has been weak. Attorney General Janet Reno says that is changing, that the Justice Department has filed 28 lawsuits against such deadbeat parents, with another 200 cases in the pipeline. The parents cited in this first batch of 28 lawsuits, says Reno, owe almost $1 million to their children. It is estimated that such parents nationwide owe $34 billion. Advocates for Children had complained that the Justice Department was slow to use the 1992 law as a tool to force deadbeat parents to pay up. Reno says it took time to coordinate with state and local offices. The penalty for violating this federal law can range up to 2 years in prison. I'm Melinda Pankava in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 12 points at 3,813. This is NPR. The family of the man who was shot in front of the White House this week has hired a lawyer. California lawyer Milton Grimes says the family of Marcelino Cornille has asked him to look into the death of the homeless man. The attorney says he believes police used excessive force when they shot Cornille, who had a large hunting knife taped to his hand. A U.S. Park police officer shot Cornille twice after the officer ordered him to drop the knife. Cornille didn't, and the officer fired. Cornille died last night in a Washington, D.C. hospital. The director of the National Cancer Institute says he'll be stepping down in April. The Cancer Institute funds most of the cancer research done in this country. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Rumors that Samuel Broder would step down have been circulating for months. The Cancer Institute has received a lot of political heat this year for the way it handled allegations of misconduct in a major breast cancer study and for changing its guidelines for when women should start getting annual breast x-rays to screen for cancer. President George Bush named Broder to head the Cancer Institute in 1989. Before he took over as head of the institute, Broder was a research scientist there. His work helped show that the drug AZT could be used to treat AIDS patients. Broder will join Florida-based IVAX Corporation as chief scientific officer. IVAX deals in personal care products, drugs, and medical diagnostic kits. A Cancer Institute spokesperson says Broder's replacement has not yet been chosen. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
Power has been restored in Manila after Typhoon Axel swept across the Philippines a few hours ago. Most of the main island of Luzon is still without electricity. Officials say it will take another day to restore service. The blackout caused commuter chaos in the capital. Traffic lights were out, gridlocking streets. Commuter trains were stopped on the tracks. Axel has killed 12 people in the central Philippines and injured dozens. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The current film, Heavenly Creatures, is based on perhaps the most celebrated murder case in New Zealand history. In 1952, Pauline Parker and her best friend Juliet Hume were about to be separated because Juliet was leaving the country with her parents. Pauline wanted to go with her best friend, but Pauline's mother wouldn't permit it. Pauline refused to let her mother stand in the way, so Pauline killed her mother with Juliet's help. Both girls were tried, found guilty, and served 5 years in prison. Their whereabouts after their release remained a mystery until last summer when a journalist revealed that Juliet is now a popular detective novelist writing under the name Anne Perry. Later we'll meet the director and co-writers of the film Heavenly Creatures. First we have an interview I recorded last September with Anne Perry. I spoke with her before the movie was released in the States. Perry's 20th book had just been published, called The Sins of the Wolf. It's the fifth in her series featuring Detective William Monk. When Monk was introduced in her novel, The Face of a Stranger, he was just regaining consciousness from an accident to find he had totally lost his memory. The most important mystery that faced him was the mystery of his own identity.
I originally thought it would only be a one-off story, and all of us, I think, when something terrible happens, the essence of detection is that you're hunting somebody else. You're hunting the monster out there. And I wondered if you gradually came closer and closer to the understanding that there are no monsters out there, that there is only us. And the most dramatic way to do that is to find that the person you're hunting is yourself. And in my very first draft, he was the one who had killed Jocelyn Gray. And then we decided that that was not a very good beginning to a series, so it had to be somebody else. But the idea was that you're hunting the other and the different, the totally unacceptable, and as you come closer and closer to it, you realize that it is yourself.
He's in the position of having to learn who he is by seeing what other people think of him, so he has to see himself,
yes,
through the eyes of others, and that can be a very unnerving experience.
Very unnerving indeed, because he learns what he has done, but not why he has done it. And so often, as one of my mother's favorite sayings, if you just knew the one thing more, you know why somebody does what they do, it all falls into place and becomes not necessarily acceptable, but at least understandable. Because almost everybody who does something, it seemed to them at the time to be the best course for them. And looking back on it, of course, it may be all sorts of other things, but he has to discover himself without knowing why he has done what he has done.
What did you imagine it would be like for this detective to learn that he was hated for certain actions that he had taken earlier in life, actions he no longer remembered?
I think it'd be very frightening, a sense of being disoriented and thinking, well, how can I be to blame for something that, in a sense, was not me? And yet was me. And you have to come to terms with it. And I think that's something that many people feel when they have grown away from the person that they used to be and yet still have to live with whatever that person has done. Because we all change as time goes by. And since I now know how old you are, I know that you've had time to understand that that's true.
I want to ask you about something that happened in your own life that really not only was quite a revelation about your life, but also gives a whole new meaning in a way to the fact that you're writing mystery novels. And, you know, I'm thinking obviously about the murder that you were involved with when you were 15 years old.
Yes.
Before we talk about the murder, tell us something about who you were then. I know you were very sick. You were in a sanitarium?
I was for a while. Who I was can be summed up, I suppose, fairly briefly. I was born in London a few months before the war. I spent some time there. We were there through the Blitz. We moved around a little bit. I wasn't evacuated. When I was about six, I became very, very ill indeed. So ill that the doctor told my mother he'd come back and sign the death certificate in the morning because there was nothing else anybody could do. Obviously, my mother pulled me through the night. But by the time I was about eight, I was ill again, and they said that I wouldn't survive another British winter. So my mother had friends who lived in the Bahamas, and I was shipped out there, and I stayed with them for a little over a year, 6 months in the Bahamas, another 8 months in New Zealand, because that was where they went, which is how I got to New Zealand in the first place. And I did recover quite a lot. I went back to my own family, no school during this time. I went back to my own family when I was 10, and I went to boarding school, which I hated because I was the different one and kids torment a different child for whatever reason. And then when I was 13, I became ill again and had to be removed from school, and I never went back. And I spent about 3 months in a sanitarium, and then I spent the rest of the time recovering at home, but I was still not yet well enough to go back to school. And I seemed to respond to the medication so well that instead of taking me off it after 3 months, as was usual, they kept me on it for 9 months. And that seemed at the time not to have done or had any effect. And I suppose I was somebody very much out of touch with other people because I had not had very much schooling or much time to spend with other teenagers. I mean, I'd been out of circulation pretty well for 2 years because at the sanitarium where I was for 3 months, I wasn't even allowed any visitors, wasn't allowed to read. And that was when Pauline became such a close friend because she was the only person who kept really touch with me apart from my parents, and she wrote to me every day.
So Pauline was your best friend. It was her mother.
Yes.
Who was murdered. She wanted to kill her mother?
Well, when I was 15, my parents separated and were going to divorce. My father lost his job, and we were about to leave the country. And Pauline was very ill also. I don't know what it was that she suffered from, but she used to throw up regularly, sometimes two or three times a day, and she was losing weight quite dramatically. She was very unhappy. I don't know the reason why, or if I knew at the time, I don't remember now. But she wanted to come with us, and my parents said, of course you may, if your parents agree. Well, I suppose pretty naturally her parents did not agree. And she felt that really coming with us was her only way of survival. I mean, I know that sounds melodramatic, but teenagers can be very melodramatic. That was how it seemed to us at the time.
So what did she propose to you?
Well, I'm not prepared to put words into her mouth. I think that would be most unfair. But let me say that I believed that if I did not join her in this, it would be the end of her life. I don't mean in a sense of happiness. I mean quite literally, physically, that she would die.
Do you remember any of the planning of the murder?
I really don't. It all happened within a space of either hours or one a day or more.
What happened?
Well, we had intended to make it look like an accident, which was pretty ridiculous. But I don't remember very clearly. I mean, partly because it was 40 years ago and I was in a state of shock and pretty upset, and I suppose partly because I've chosen not to remember it.
What do you know now about the murder from what you've since read and been told?
Well, it really is what I've been told. I haven't read. It was quick. I know that, and it was fairly violent. But beyond that, I don't remember very much. I really truly don't remember.
I've read that your friend bludgeoned her mother 45 times with a half brick that you gave her and that you had admitted to striking at least one blow yourself. Does that seem at all accurate?
45 seems a little bit excessive. I don't know. I would have thought half a dozen was more like it, but we were both questioned without any adult present, either lawyer or parent or anybody else.
Questioned by authorities?
By the police.
Mm-hmm.
And if 45 was said, I have no idea. I don't think it was said by me.
Did you know her mother at all?
I'd met her. I mean, I couldn't say I knew her well. I'd met her.
Do you remember what you felt either during or after the murder?
I don't, no. I was pretty shocked. And don't forget, I'd just discovered that my parents were separating. My father had lost his job. And it seemed to me that my best friend was on the brink of death as well.
And you mentioned the medicine you were taking. I think in retrospect that medicine might have impaired your judgment?
Well, it has been withdrawn because it tends to have that effect. I really can't say how much it affected me. I mean, I'm not competent to say. And there's no good asking me what it is because it's 40 years ago. And, you know, the thing had a name a yard long.
How did you explain what happened to yourself and to other people?
I don't explain it. I just say I was wrong. I mean, my motivation was that I thought it was one life or another, which may sound daft now, but that's how I felt at the time. I truly believed that she would take her own life if I didn't do this, and I just couldn't face the thought that she would take her life, and I would be to blame for that. Which it would have been far better, of course, if I could have found somebody who would have listened, who would have believed, and who could have prevented it. But in 24, 48 hours, or whatever, and my parents distressed with their own situation, I didn't look for anybody. I didn't know where to turn. I didn't have other friends and contacts that I could go to. Which doesn't make it right, but that was how it seemed to me at the time.
Did your family stick with you during the trial?
Oh, yes. But don't forget, at 15, you're not allowed to plead anyway. So none of this came out then, because you don't get to say anything at all.
So you didn't have to talk at the trial at all?
You're not allowed to.
Was that a relief that you didn't have to speak, or did you want to get up there and try to explain yourself?
I would love to have been able to explain. No, it was not the way that they said, because they said all sorts of crazy things.
Like what?
Well, Pauline kept a diary, and as you do in America, refer to the toilet as the John. In her family, it was referred to as George. You know, you'd say, excuse me, I was going to go and see George if you wanted to go to the toilet. And she would make notes at night if she'd had to get up during the night and say, had to go and see George. And they made an affair out of that. I mean, a love affair.
Wow.
And I wanted to say, look, just a minute, she means she went to the toilet. But, you know, you can't say anything. And the whole thing became absurd, as if we were out with strings of men. We did once get up in the night and go out on a bike ride to the beach and have a swim. Just the two of us. But when you can't say anything, they can say anything they wish about you, and you have no opportunity to rebut it or to give the very obvious and very simple explanation.
Well, could you have told your lawyer?
I don't remember having much access to him, honestly. And anyway, they were trying to make the defense of insanity, so I presume they wanted to make us seem as crazy as possible.
Your lawyer wanted to...
That was the defense, insanity, which didn't work. I mean, we were totally sane, and we were found to be so.
Now, how did you feel about somebody pleading that you were insane?
Horrible. Absolutely terrible. But that was considered to be the best legal advice at the time. Added to which, of course, now the trial names would be suppressed and it would be held, we use the term in camera, I'm not sure what term you use, but at least, you know, as a juvenile, it would not be given full rein in the press. But then it was absolutely full rein. It was a full adult trial.
My guest is writer Ann Perry. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview recorded last September with detective novelist Ann Perry. The new movie Heavenly Creatures is based on her childhood friendship with Pauline Parker and the murder they committed over 40 years ago. I know you spent about, I think it was 5.5 years in prison.
Yes.
You were 15. What was the prison like and what... It was a prison for adult women, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I believe it was the toughest adult facility in the Southern Hemisphere.
So what kind of crimes were the other women who you came in contact with found guilty of?
Pretty well everything.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of prostitution, mm-hmm. some of abortion, some of theft, embezzlement, crimes of violence, all sorts of things. It was the maximum security prison.
So what kind of cell were you in? What kind of living conditions were you living in?
One great benefit, I had a cell to myself. But other than that, it was a stone cell, 5 paces by 5. The greatest difficulty was not being able to be clean, because there was only, 2 toilets between 35 of us, and they didn't have doors, so there was no privacy. And showers, 2 showers a week, timed. And no sanitary protection other than what you wash out by hand.
Were you afraid of the other women?
Oh, yes, at times. Very, very frightened.
Did they give you good reason to be afraid?
I was never beaten up, but I was pretty scared that I might be at some time. I was the only person underage there, and I suppose I learned that if you curl up like a hedgehog or whatever, somebody else will usually come to your defense. But, oh, yeah, I had times when I was pretty scared, yes.
How did you spend your time in prison? Were you able to read?
A little bit. I used to learn a lot of poetry by heart. But, of course, we worked.
What kind of work did you have?
I sewed.
So after your 5.5 years in prison, you were released, and the authorities gave you a new identity. Was that,
yes.
Was that a typical... A typical way of releasing a young woman, then? This was still
no
in New
idea.
Zealand, right?
I've no idea. I don't think I was ever treated as typical at any point, because normally they wouldn't have put a 15-year-old into a maximum security adult prison. I don't think they had any previous standard by which to judge. When they released me, it was absolutely completely with no parole report or anything of the sort. They were very good to me on release.
Why did they give you a new identity?
Because of the sort of hullabaloo surrounding the old one. If 40 years afterwards you can get the kind of noise that you've got now about it, imagine what it would have been at the time.
So when you got a new identity, what did they give you? A new name? A change of venue? What did they help you with?
Well, both. They gave me a new name and a passport in that name, and I returned to Britain where my family was. I came straight home.
And did the people there know about the trial?
Well, my parents' closest friends knew, yes. But the people in general, no, of course not.
So it hadn't gotten publicity in England?
That I was released? Oh, the original, yes, that got publicity everywhere.
Oh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
But when I was released, no, that was done very quietly, and I just went back to my family.
And so
to my mother and stepfather.
So the people you knew there didn't make the connection? They either hadn't seen your picture or they didn't know you before?
Well, it was from 15 to 21, you do change quite a bit in appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And no, nobody made the connection. There has never been any problem whatever until about 6 weeks ago.
What happened 6 weeks ago that made this story a public story?
Some journalist in New Zealand managed to trace me and make the connection and then made it public.
How did you feel about that?
Absolutely terrible. For the first 2 or 3 nights, I would almost like to have died. I thought it would kill my mother. I thought it would probably devastate the complete life that I had built up for myself, and not only ruin me, but ruin all those that I care about, my family and those who depend upon me one way or another. But thank heaven for so many incredibly fine people. It hasn't at all. My mother's a very brave woman indeed, and she's fine. The village where I live, every single person that's had anything to say at all, it's been with complete kindness and horror that this should have happened.
Have you felt at all a sense of relief that something that you've had to keep secret for so long, you don't have to keep secret any longer?
Well, just occasionally there's a little spark of relief, yes, when I begin to realize that anybody who accepts me now accepts me for what I am and without reservation. But I wouldn't have chosen for this to happen. I mean, it has been a very, very painful experience. It's very encouraging that there are so many extraordinarily good people. And I would say to anybody that there's far more goodwill out there than there is malice.
I wonder if you feel like you still have to cope with feelings of guilt from
no, I don't.
40 years ago. How did you resolve that for yourself? I think sometimes the hardest person to forgive is yourself.
Yes, that's true. By within the first two or three months, getting down on my knees and saying, I am sorry, I was at fault. I truly am sorry, and from now on, I will do everything I can to be the best person I know how. I think a lot of guilt stems from somehow or another still trying to defend yourself. You see, I never felt wicked. I never thought I would get anything out of it for myself. And it's getting over the trying to make excuses, trying to think, well, it wasn't really me, and saying, yes, I was at fault. Yes, I am sorry. And then from there on, you go on. You can't beat yourself with the past forever. It doesn't help anybody. And being sorry isn't a matter of thinking that you personally ought to suffer some more somehow or another. It's doing the best you can to live the very best life that you know how, and to make darn sure you forgive others as you would wish to be forgiven.
Now, I know that you didn't set out to write mystery novels. You started out writing, I guess, historical novels. And then when you started writing mysteries, they sold. So you stuck with it, although you're trying to branch out to other other forms now. But of course I wonder what it's been like for you to dwell on murder and detection in so much.
Well, I dwell
fiction.
On detection. I don't dwell on murder a great deal. If you read my stories, you'll find that there's very seldom pain involved. If there's violence, it's pretty quick. I never actually have violence on stage, so to speak. I don't have anybody dying particularly painfully. Even if the corpse is mutilated, it's after they're dead. Also, I don't make the issues black and white. Any crime usually involves several people being at fault and various other sins and peccadilloes, secrets, whatever, of everybody concerned. It's very seldom one wicked person and everybody else is good, because life isn't like that.
So do you feel there's any connection at all in your life between writing mysteries and being involved with the murder?
Only in that I now care a great deal more than I used to about right and wrong, and I have a more of a sympathy and an understanding how you can do something wrong because you're jammed into a corner and you're scared and you haven't time to think. And that issues are not as black and white as they might sometimes appear to be. I think I've got a less judgmental attitude than I would have had if my life had gone differently. I think I might have been a good deal more cocky, more assured of myself, more assured of the world, had I had an easier path, had I never done anything which I regret.
How did you start to write? How old were you when you realized you wanted to do that? And how did you make a living before that?
Oh, I always either told stories or wrote them down as far back as I can remember. My mother used to tell me stories when I was, you know, 2 or 3 years old. I actually started trying to write for publication in my mid-20s. It took me about 12 years at least to get anything accepted. And I worked at general secretarial work and various other things. I was an air stewardess and a ship and shore stewardess at sea and a limousine dispatcher and worked in insurance and worked in a shop. All sorts of different things, but the only thing I ever wanted to do was write.
Ann Perry is a mystery writer. Her latest book is called The Sins of the Wolf. In the second part of our show, we'll hear from the director and co-writers of the film Heavenly Creatures, based on the murder Perry helped commit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, uncovering a 40-year-old story of obsession, fantasy, and murder. We meet film director Peter Jackson and screenwriter Frances Walsh. Their new movie, Heavenly Creatures, is based on the true story of two girls in New Zealand in the early 50s whose friendship culminated in murdering the mother of one of the girls. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Little Women. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Ireland's new government has announced it will release 9 members of the Irish Republican Army from prison before the end of their sentences. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The early release of the prisoners had originally been planned for November, but was canceled after 2 Irish Republicans were arrested for killing a postman in Northern Ireland. The shooting was a rare breach of the IRA's 4-month ceasefire, which has allowed its political wing to enter talks with the British government. The 9 prisoners, including 2 convicted murderers, are among 55 IRA members now held in Irish jails, and they will have to report to police regularly after their release tomorrow. 30 others will be granted Christmas leave. Protestant politicians in Northern Ireland reacted angrily to the news. The Reverend Ian Paisley, a member of the British Parliament, called the move outrageous because the IRA has so far refused to give up its huge stockpiles of weapons. Britain has not agreed to release any of the IRA prisoners it holds, although it is granting Christmas furloughs to several hundred. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Congressman Bill Richardson says he believes Army helicopter pilot Bobby Hall will be home by Christmas. Richardson is accompanying the body of Hall's crewmate, David Heilman, who died when the helicopter the pilots were in went down in North Korea. Hall escaped, apparently unharmed. Richardson told NBC today he believes North Korean diplomats are convinced the pilots were lost and didn't deliberately cross over into North Korean territory. Today was the last day on the job for President Clinton's press secretary, Dee Dee Myers. She was the first woman to hold the job, one of the most visible positions in government. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
Myers began her last news briefing as a faithful press secretary, listing President Clinton's top 10 accomplishments of 1994. But she then added her own list of the top 10 things she won't miss about the job, including being paged in the middle of the night, rushing to briefings, and the food on the presidential plane. Myers was the first woman to hold the high-profile job of press secretary. She said although she was treated fairly in the White House, Washington is still a town dominated by men.
I think it is always more difficult, or often more difficult, not always, for women to have the same authority and the same credibility that men have. Again, I think that's changing. But I think there are still obstacles.
Myers said she had no immediate plans except to relax, but she said she's had a number of interesting offers. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The Associated Press is quoting a White House source who says Congressman Dan Glickman of Kansas will be nominated to replace outgoing Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy. Glickman lost his seat in last month's elections. It's not clear when President Clinton will formally name his nominee, but Espy is leaving at the end of the month. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow gained 13 points to end at 3,681. Declines led advances by a margin of 6-5. This is NPR. Russian soldiers have bombed Grozny, the capital of the separatist region of Chechnya, today. The city is under siege. Russian forces are firing artillery shells into the city center. Reporters there say some 2 dozen people have died. One Russian warplane apparently fired rockets into a residential neighborhood of the city. The pilot then fired another rocket into a crowd of people who had gathered to inspect the damage. Chechen fighters don't have much ammunition, therefore they can't fight back. The government of Burundi has imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew on its capital, Bujumbura, because of rising ethnic violence that's left at least 30 people dead in the last week. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Nairobi.
Ever since Rwanda exploded into massacres and war last April, foreign governments have been nervously looking south toward Burundi. Burundi has the same ethnic mix as Rwanda, mostly Hutus with a Tutsi minority, and the same history of ethnic tension. The big difference is that in Rwanda, Hutus held power for most of the 30 years since independence, while in Burundi, the Tutsi minority controlled the government until last year. Just 6 months before Rwanda exploded, Burundi shook with a wave of ethnic violence that left tens of thousands dead. Now, killings by Hutu militias and the Tutsi-dominated army are on the rise, and the main Tutsi opposition party is threatening to pull out of the coalition government. The new curfew may quiet the city, but it won't calm the brewing ethnic crisis. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
The Mexican peso has fallen nearly 20% in value today after the government scrapped its policy of trying to shore up the currency against the dollar. The move by new President Ernesto Zedillo was supposed to calm the battered Mexican financial markets, but so far his action seems to have backfired. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first part of our show, we heard from detective writer Ann Perry. Last summer, she admitted that she used to be known as Juliet Hume, and that 40 years ago she was involved in a famous New Zealand murder case. When she was 15, she helped her best friend, Pauline Parker, murder Pauline's mother. The story of their friendship and the murder is told in the current film Heavenly Creatures. Heavenly Creatures is number 3 on Time Magazine's 1994 list of the 10 best films. We called the film's director, Peter Jackson, and Francis Walsh, who co-wrote the movie with Jackson. They're married and live in New Zealand, where the movie is set. I asked if their film led to the revelation of Ann Perry's identity.
The rumor about Ann Perry has been going around New Zealand for at least 2 years. How that came about, we have found out, is that there was a play based on the Parker Hume murder case, a play called The Daughters of Heaven, which was premiered in a Wellington theatre about 2 years ago, before we started making the movie. We'd already written a script, but we hadn't started shooting the film. And we had, during the course of our research, we'd attempted to interview an old friend of Ann Perry's, or Juliet Hume, a person that was at school with her. And Fran actually spoke to this woman, and she said, well, I can't actually talk to you. I feel too compromised because I still correspond with Juliet. I still write to her. In fact, I wrote to her last week. And we said, oh, wow, okay, well, that's fair enough. We understand. But then we heard later that this same person had attended the premiere of the play, and at the party afterwards, I could only assume it was a few drinks had loosened her tongue, and she'd actually told one of the actors in the play Juliet's real identity. And, you know, if you want to keep a secret, you don't tell the acting fraternity, because they're the biggest kind of gossip trail that there is. And so this news that Juliet Hume now wrote murder novels and she lived in Scotland, her name was Ann Perry, this whole thing was started to circulate around the New Zealand theatre circles. We heard it through an actor who told us, who'd heard it from this other person. So it was just spreading, and we went into the movie wanting to protect her identity as much as we could. We didn't tell any of the actors in our film who she was. We didn't tell Kate Winslet, who plays Juliet in the film, her identity. We just didn't tell anybody because we hoped that this would never be published, because at this stage it was a rumor. It hadn't reached a journalist. And it took a long time, and it was only about 4 or 5 months ago, again, before the movie was ever seen by anybody, that a journalist overheard it at a party. A New Zealand journalist was at a party, heard this news, and published the story. She did some research and published it.
The movie is based in part on Pauline's diaries, which were reprinted in part in the newspaper in New Zealand. Now, Ann Perry said that some of the things that Pauline wrote in those diaries were misunderstood. She said, for instance, in Pauline's family, the John was called George. So if Pauline wrote in her diary, I saw George last night, she meant I went to the bathroom during the night.
And
she said at the trial that was misinterpreted to mean that Pauline had had an affair, but that she didn't. It was just a misunderstanding of what George meant. What do you make of that?
Well, Pauline wrote a lot of her diary in code, and some of the code we have understood because it was revealed in court and she admitted it to psychiatrists and things, and some of it we probably don't know about. The fact that she had an affair with one of the boarders in the house is not in dispute. She refers to that openly in her diary on many occasions. She refers to being caught in bed with this boarder by her father, the boarder being expelled from the house, her going out at night to see this boarder. And the fact that she thought at the time she might love him and that it was causing this rift with Juliet. Those things are not in doubt, and we would never have put something in the film that was open to interpretation in that way. It was verified, and certainly this border was approached by the police when they were investigating the murder, and he was questioned at length and confirmed it as well. But certainly they spoke in code, and you know, which is again part of the exclusive world that they were building up for themselves. And Pauline would record stuff in code in her diary.
I think what Anne Perry was saying is largely true, but if she was attempting to say that Pauline had no relationship with a boy, then that's not right, because we know for a fact that she did. You know, reading the diaries, it's very clear, and as Fran says, it came out in the trial that this guy was spoken to by the police, and so there's no doubt of that particular piece of information.
I think possibly what the court did do, which Anne Perry was objecting to, was that they perceived every forbidden or illicit act by these girls in the worst possible light, so that sneaking out at night could only mean that they were rushing off to sea and sleep with boys or something, whereas often it was quite harmless frolicking about on the lawn. Or
there's a very funny extract in Pauline's diary where she describes how she and Juliet are going to rewrite the Bible, that they think that they can do a much better job, and this is actually very funny. I mean, you read it, but you know, in court this was presented as evidence of their insanity, that to actually say such outrageous things about the Bible as proves that they're mad. I mean, I it was like the humour, the very funny humour that these two girls had was twisted into you know, very horrible proportions in the trial. And I'm sure that, you know, Pauline and Juliet both having to sit in court hearing all this stuff must have been very frustrating. And obviously it's something that Anne Perry's never quite gotten over.
My guests are director Peter Jackson and screenwriter Frances Walsh. They made the movie Heavenly Creatures. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us by phone from New Zealand is Peter Jackson, who directed the film Heavenly Creatures, and Frances Walsh, who co-wrote the film with Jackson. I know you interviewed a lot of people who knew the two girls. I think you spoke to former teachers, to friends, to neighbors. What are some of the interesting insights you found about them?
Well, the most interesting insights came from classmates, who obviously knew these girls before the murder happened and didn't have a jaundiced view of them, viewed them as peers, contemporaries, who were, albeit a bit withdrawn from them and didn't choose to mix with them, but who were not, you know, primarily murderers. And the classmates had a very humane view of these girls and provided for us real insight into what they were like as people, which was hugely beneficial in writing the script. But they were also quite unanimous in the way they saw these two girls, that Pauline was this very withdrawn, sulky, weighted-down character who was depressive and crotchety a lot of the time. And Juliet was this outgoing, stately, blonde young woman who could take on the world, very articulate, but also very needy. And these pictures were sort of slowly built up by the classmates, and it provided really the foundation, you know, for writing the characters in the story.
We also had to deal with 40 years worth of prejudice and dinner time table conversation that had built up and had mythologized some of the aspects of the case. It was interesting because one of the almost unanimous things that we heard from people that were involved after the murder, so policemen, psychiatrists, people who were involved in the prison, anybody that came into contact with them immediately after the murder, obviously they saw them as murderers. But the thing that everybody was very clear about, and this has gone down in New Zealand mythology, was that Juliet was really the ringleader, and that she, more than Pauline, took some sarcastic or some some sarcastic delight in goading Pauline into killing her mother. And this was a very clear impression that was related to us again and again. And initially we believed that because that's what the mythology is. And in a way that, you know, is how Juliet has always been perceived as being really this English girl that arrived in New Zealand. A couple of years later, she was involved in this murder where she was probably the ringleader, and then she left and you know, and went back to her family. And there's this bitterness that still is apparent to do with Juliet. And we actually, the more research we did, we went further and deeper and spoke to people that knew Juliet better, knew both of the girls better, knew the families. And we actually don't believe that. We think that that's a very false impression, and it was largely gained by the fact that immediately after the murder, Pauline clamped up. She didn't say anything. She would sit in her prison cell, not saying a word, being very morose, being very sullen, looking as if she had no mind of her own, that she was basically, you know, would do anything Juliet would tell her. Juliet was in a hyper state of a sort of a state of continual panic, almost, where she was just talking constantly, saying some fairly outrageous things, and really it gave people this impression that she was the ringleader. And I think that hopefully the film, you know, does actually rectify that a bit. We don't believe that was the truth.
This is how Ann Perry describes her participation in the murder. She says that she believed, you know, Ann Perry was leaving New Zealand at the time with... And she believed that if Pauline wasn't allowed to come with her, because Pauline really wanted to come, that she would just die, that she'd kill herself.
Well,
and
I
so
mean,
she
I
thought it was a choice between two lives, you know, either Pauline would kill her mother or Pauline would kill herself, and she didn't want to see her friend
die. I can understand that to a certain extent. There are a lot of passages in Pauline's diary where she talks about suicide. She was a very unstable character, if you like. She you know, and some passengers in her diary, she's talking about how life is not worth living, that death would be a much easier way out. And then the next day she's talking about how brilliant her and Juliet are. She was very much up and down.
I think that you have to weigh that up against Juliet's extraordinary arrogance and her sense of her supercilious sense of self, because she genuine belief that she was of more value than other people, and she developed a whole belief system which supported this, and it was all to do with the fourth world and that she and Pauline had extra parts of their brain and everything else, and all of this led her down a path which belittled the taking of human life. And that is the other side of that we have a line in the film which is a direct quote from Juliet, where she said, only the best people strive against all obstacles in the pursuit of happiness. And certainly afterwards, when she was interviewed by a defense psychiatrist, she said that the taking of human life was justified if it was deemed necessary to her to, you know, if things got in her way, then yes, she would kill. And that wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because she was outside of the values of society. So... you know, that was the other side. She developed a very warped philosophy which justified murder.
It must have been hard to find two teenage girls who were as good as the leading actresses you found for the film.
It was hard. It wasn't so hard to find Kate Winslet, who plays Juliet. Because Juliet was English, we wanted to cast somebody out of England, so we flew to London and we auditioned, I guess, 50 or 60 English actresses, and we found Kate, and you know, and I was very convinced that I wanted to get people with close physical resemblances to the real life characters, not just the two girls but the parents. Like, everybody in the movie bears a very close resemblance to the real people, and Kate looked like Juliet Hume, and she had this wonderful talent, and so we found her reasonably quickly. But Pauline Parker was a much more difficult character to find, and we were casting, again, looking for 15-year-olds, because I wanted to cast, you know, Pauline and Juliet being in the age of 15, 16. I didn't want to put a 25-year-old in a school uniform. So we started looking in New Zealand, and over a period of 4 or 5 months, we auditioned what I think was about 500 or 600 women, young women, putting them on tape. And about 4 weeks before we were due to start shooting the movie, we still hadn't found her. I'd had a couple of people on a shortlist, but I wasn't happy. And so Fran actually jumped into a car and started driving through New Zealand, stopping at schools And she'd take a picture of Pauline Parker into the principal and say, well, look, if, you know, is there anybody in your school that's interested in acting that looks like Pauline Parker? And Fran eventually arrived at New Plymouth Girls High School, which is in a small New Zealand town, and she found Melanie Linsky, who had never acted before, was interested in acting but hadn't had any experience. And she was 15, and she called me. I was in Christchurch and during the pre-production of the film, and she said, look, I think I found someone really interesting and you should fly them down and audition them. And so we did. We actually auditioned Melanie a couple of times, and then we decided to take the risk. It was a risk because she was hadn't had any experience, but she did have that special quality. She had that enigma, that fascinating sort of enigma that I was looking for. And
that's a really fine performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's extraordinary.
So, you know, meanwhile, we've been talking about Ann Perry and what she's had to say about the case. No one knows where Pauline Parker is. Do you want her to be tracked down, or would you just assume that this all remain a mystery?
Well, I just don't. I mean, mystery or whatever aside, I just don't want her to be found. I think, it's nothing to do with the movie. I don't care. I just want her to be able to have her privacy. I mean, I wish that it happened with Ann Perry as well. We never wanted any of this to happen. And, you know, neither Juliet or Pauline are Nazi war criminals. They don't deserve to be tracked down 40 years later. And Ann Perry has resources. I mean, she has, you know, money and has the ability to hire publicists to look after her. And she has an agent. But, you know, Pauline, as far as we know, doesn't have these resources and has lived a life, you know, full of remorse for what she's done. So I think in no way does she deserve to be made public where her current whereabouts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Jackson directed the film Heavenly Creatures and co-wrote it with Francis Walsh. They spoke to us from their home in New Zealand. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on All Things Considered on yesterday's subway bombing in New York?
Hi, Terry. Melissa Block reports on the arrest of Edward Leary, who police have charged with carrying a firebomb that went off on the train yesterday. Other stories, Anne Garrels has more on the struggle in the Chechen capital, Grozny. From Britain, Michael Goldfarb reports on a somewhat bleak political future, it appears, for Prime Minister John Major. Michael Scholar on efforts to prosecute those who were responsible for the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda. Also, we'll have letters from listeners and a report on the troubles the Queen Elizabeth II is having. Many of the passengers are protesting the conditions on the QE2.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 1978 film My Brilliant Career instantly established Australian director Gillian Armstrong on the world movie scene. She hasn't had any hits since, but films like Mrs. Sofal in 1984 and High Tide in 1987 have kept her reputation strong. Armstrong's new movie is an adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's most famous book, which has already been filmed 3 times. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest version of Little Women.
The world doesn't really need a new version of Little Women. It hasn't needed one, in fact, since the first version, which was directed very beautifully by George Cukor in 1933. If you remember how beguiling Katharine Hepburn was in that movie as Jo, the spirited sister who wants to be a novelist, you may wince when you hear that the new version features Winona Ryder in the role. And wince you should. Ryder has always been more a Generation X icon than an actress. And the older she gets, the more forced and obvious her frantic imitations of sadness, wonder, and gaiety seem. The fact that she leaves this Little Women almost unharmed is a measure of just how lovely it is. Gillian Armstrong has made this movie with an enormous amount of delicacy, tenderness, and grace. The setting is Concord, Massachusetts, near the end of the Civil War, and the family on display is the Marches, poor but lively and well-bred girls who are being reared with all the best liberal values by their mother. She's played with a little too much stalwart virtue by Susan Sarandon. Most of the other performances, though, are just fine, and Winona Ryder's excesses are easily counterbalanced by the work of Christian Bale, who's lively and sensitive as the rich neighbor boy Theodore Lawrence, better known as Laurie. In this scene, Ryder, as Joe, bumps into him at a stuffy Christmas party and takes the opportunity to get to know him better.
Is it true that you lived in Italy among artists and vagrants? Well, my mother was Italian, a pianist. Grandfather disapproved of her.
Truly? I saw a play like that once. Do you like the theater?
Oh, yes.
Were you born there?
Where? In Italy.
Do you speak French or Italian?
English at home. Francais à l'école, the music conservatory in Vevey. But grandfather's having me tutored now. He insists I go to college.
Oh, I'd commit murder to go to college. Actually, if I were going to be a writer, I'd go to New York and pursue the stage. Are you shocked?
Very.
Maybe the best thing about the movie is its sense of balance. There's sentiment here, but no sentimentality. There's a feminist undercurrent, but except for a few of Sarandon's speeches, it remains an undercurrent. And the storybook settings of New England and Victorian New York are enchanting without being too showy. The movie is an idealized portrait of what a family ought to be, and yet it never feels didactic or condescending, and most of the time the ensemble acting seems genuinely heartfelt. The big surprise in the cast is the one actor who doesn't come from the movies, Claire Danes, the star of the mopey TV series My So-Called Life. She plays the sickly middle sister, Beth. It's always been a thankless role. Beth is the character who ails and dies and is always good, like Melanie in Gone with the Wind. She seems born to be boring, but not in Danes' performance. A great many actresses can suffer and cry at will on the screen, but Danes adds startling layers of expectation, hope, and gratitude. In some scenes, you can see that the other actors around her are being torn to pieces by her performance. Even Ryder begins to look as though she's really feeling something. If you're anything like me, by the time we get this close to Christmas, any movie that offers peace on earth and warm family sentiments is a must to avoid. Little Women, though, is good enough to muffle your inner Scrooge, at least for a couple of hours.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Bob Alls, and Fred Snyder. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
My costume is green. I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris' Santa Land Diaries. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.